Chapter 2 of Emily Climbs by Lucy Maud Montgomery. This Legamoose recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 2 Salad Days Part 1 This book is not going to be wholly, or even mainly, made up of extracts from Emily's diary, but by way of linking up matters unimportant enough for a chapter in themselves, and yet necessary for a proper understanding of her personality and environment, I am going to include some more of them. Besides, when one has material ready to hand, why not use it? Emily's diary, with all its youthful crudities and italics, really gives a better interpretation of her and her imaginative and introspective mind, in that her 14th spring, than any biographer, however sympathetic, could do. So let us take another peep into the yellowed pages of that old Jimmy book, written long ago in the lookout of New Moon. February 15th, 19-something. I have decided that I will write down in this journal, every day, all my good deeds and all my bad ones. I got the idea out of a book, and it appeals to me. I mean to be as honest about it as I can. It will be easy, of course, to write down the good deeds, but not so easy to record the bad ones. I did only one bad thing today, only one thing that I think bad, that is. I was impertinent to Aunt Elizabeth. She thought I took too long washing the dishes. I didn't suppose there was any hurry, and I was composing a story called The Secret of the Mill. Aunt Elizabeth looked at me and then at the clock, and said in her most disagreeable way, "Is the snail your sister, Emily?" "No, snails are no relation to me," I said haughtily. It was not what I said, but the way I said it that was impertinent, and I meant it to be. I was very angry. Sarcastic speeches always aggravate me. Afterwards, I was very sorry that I had been in a temper, but I was sorry because it was foolish and undignified, not because it was wicked. So I suppose that was not true repentance. As for my good deeds, I did two today. I saved two little lives. Saucy Sal had caught a poor snowbird, and I took it from her. It flew off quite briskly, and I am sure it felt wonderfully happy. Later on, I went down to the cellar cupboard and found a mouse caught in a trap by its foot. The poor thing lay there, almost exhausted from struggling, with such a look in its black eyes. I couldn't endure it, so I set it free, and it managed to get away quite smartly in spite of its foot. I do not feel sure about this deed. I know it was a good one from the mouse's point of view, but what about Aunt Elizabeth's? This evening Aunt Laura and Aunt Elizabeth read and burned a box full of old letters. They read them aloud and commented on them, while I sat in a corner and knitted my stockings. The letters were very interesting, and I learned a great deal about the Murrays I had never known before. I feel that it is quite wonderful to belong to a family like this. No wonder the Blairwater folks call us the chosen people, though they don't mean it as a compliment. I feel that I must live up to the traditions of my family. I had a long letter from Dean Priest today. He is spending the winter in Algiers. He says he is coming home in April, and is going to take rooms with his sister, Mrs. Fred Evans, for the summer. I am so glad. It will be splendid to have him in Blairwater all summer. Nobody ever talks to me as Dean does. He is the nicest and most interesting old person I know. Aunt Elizabeth says he is selfish, as all the priests are. But then she does not like the priests, and she always calls him Jarback, which somehow sets my teeth on edge. One of Dean's shoulders is a little higher than the other, but that is not his fault. I told Aunt Elizabeth once that I wished she would not call my friend that, but she only said, "I did not nickname your friend, Emily. His own clan have always called him Jarback. The priests are not noted for delicacy." Teddy had a letter from Dean, too, and a book, The Lives of Great Artists, Michelangelo, Raphael, Velasquez, Rembrandt, Titian. He says he dare not let his mother see him reading it. She would burn it. I am sure Teddy could only have his chance, he would be as great an artist as any of them. February 18, 19. I had a lovely time with myself this evening after school, walking on the brook road in Lofty John's bush. The sun was low and creamy, and the snow so white, and the shadows so slender and blue. I think there is nothing so beautiful as tree shadows. And when I came out into the garden, my own shadow looked so funny, so long, that it stretched right across the garden. I immediately made a poem, of which two lines were, "If we were as tall as our shadows, how tall our shadows would be." I think there is such a good deal of philosophy in that. Tonight I wrote a story, and Aunt Elizabeth knew what I was doing, and was very much annoyed. She scolded me for wasting time. But it wasn't wasted time. I grew in it. I know I did. And there was something about one of the sentences I liked. "I am afraid of the gray wood." That pleased me very much. And, "White and stately she walked the dark wood like a moonbeam." I think that is rather fine. Yet Mr. Carpenter tells me that whenever I think a thing especially fine, I am to cut it out. But, oh, I can't cut that out. Not yet, at least. The strange part is that about 3 months after Mr. Carpenter tells me to cut a thing out, I come round to his point of view and feel ashamed of it. Mr. Carpenter was quite merciless over my essay today. Nothing about it suited him. "Three alasses in one paragraph, Emily. One would have been too many in this year of grace. More irresistible! Emily, for heaven's sake, write English. That is unpardonable." It was, too. I saw it for myself, and I felt shame going all over me from head to foot like a red wave. Then, after Mr. Carpenter had penciled almost every sentence, and sneered at all my fine phrases, and found fault with most of my constructions, and told me I was too fond of putting cleverisms into everything I wrote, he flung my exercise book down, tore at his hair, and said, "You write! Jade, get a spoon and learn to cook!" Then he strode off, muttering maledictions, not loud but deep. I picked up my poor essay, and didn't feel very badly. I can cook already, and I have learned a thing or two about Mr. Carpenter. The better my essays are, the more he rages over them. This one must have been quite good. But it makes him so angry and impatient to see where I might have made it still better and didn't, through carelessness or laziness or indifference, as he thinks. And he can't tolerate a person who could do better and doesn't. And he wouldn't bother with me at all if he didn't think I may amount to something by and by. Aunt Elizabeth does not approve of Mr. Johnson. She thinks his theology is not sound. He said in his sermon last Sunday that there was some good in Buddhism. "He will be saying that there is some good in popery next," said Aunt Elizabeth indignantly at the dinner table. "There may be some good in Buddhism. I must ask Dean about it when he comes home." March 2, 19. We were all at a funeral today, old Mrs. Sarah Paul. I have always liked going to funerals. When I said that, Aunt Elizabeth looked shocked, and Aunt Laura said, "Oh, Emily, dear!" I rather like to shock Aunt Elizabeth, but I never feel comfortable if I worry Aunt Laura. She's such a darling. So I explained, or tried to explain to. It is sometimes very hard to explain things to Aunt Elizabeth. "Funerals are interesting," I said, "and humorous, too." I think I only made matters worse by saying that. And yet Aunt Elizabeth knew as well as I did that it was funny to see some of those relatives of Mrs. Paul, who have fought with her and hated her for years, she wasn't amiable if she is dead, sitting there, holding their handkerchiefs to their faces and pretending to cry. I knew quite well what each and every one was thinking in his heart. Jake Paul was wondering if the old harridan had by any chance left him anything in her will, and Alice Paul, who knew she wouldn't get anything, was hoping Jake Paul wouldn't either. That would satisfy her. And Mrs. Charles Paul was wondering how soon it would be decent to do the house over the way she had always wanted it and Mrs. Paul hadn't. And Auntie Min was worrying for fear there wouldn't be enough baked meats for such a mob of fourth cousins that they never expected and didn't want, And Lisette Paul was counting the people and feeling vexed because there wasn't as large an attendance as there was at Mrs. Henry Lister's funeral last week. When I told Aunt Laura this, she said gravely, "All this may be true, Emily." She knew it was. "But somehow it doesn't seem quite right for so young a girl as you to be able to see these things, in short. However, I can't help seeing them. Darling Aunt Laura is always so sorry for people that she can't see their humorous side. But I saw other things, too. I saw that little Zack Fritz, whom Mrs. Paul adopted and was very kind to, was almost broken-hearted, and I saw that Martha Paul was feeling sorry and ashamed to think of her bitter old quarrel with Mrs. Paul, and I saw that Mrs. Paul's face, that looked so discontented and thwarted in life, looked peaceful and majestic and even beautiful, as if death had satisfied her at last. Yes, funerals are interesting. March 5th, 19-something. It is snowing a little tonight. I love to see the snow coming down in slanting lines across the dark trees. I think I did a good deed today. Jason Marrowby was here helping Cousin Jimmy saw wood, and I saw him sneak into the pig house and take a swig from a whiskey bottle. But I did not say one word about it to anyone. That is my good deed. Perhaps I ought to tell Aunt Elizabeth. But if I did, she would never have him again, and he needs all the work he can get for his poor wife's and children's sakes. I find it is not always easy to be sure whether your deeds are good or bad. March 20th, 19-something. Yesterday Aunt Elizabeth was very angry because I would not write an obituary poem for old Peter De Geer, who died last week. Mrs. De Geer came here and asked me to do it. I wouldn't. I felt very indignant at such a request. I felt it would be a desecration of my art to do such a thing, though of course I didn't say that to Mrs. De Geer. For one thing, it would have hurt her feelings, and for another, she wouldn't have had the faintest idea what I meant. Even Aunt Elizabeth hadn't, when I told her my reasons for refusing, after Mrs. De Geer had gone. "You are always writing yards of trash that nobody wants," she said. "I think you might write something that is wanted. It would have pleased poor old Mary De Geer. Desecration of your art, indeed! If you must talk, Emily, why not talk sense?" I proceeded to talk sense. "Aunt Elizabeth," I said seriously, "how could I write that obituary poem for her? I couldn't write an untruthful one to please anybody. And you know yourself that nothing good and truthful could be said about Peter De Geer." Aunt Elizabeth did know it, and it posed her, but she was all the more displeased with me for that. She vexed me so much that I came up to my room and wrote an obituary poem about Peter, just for my own satisfaction. It is certainly great fun to write a truthful obituary of someone you don't like. Not that I disliked Peter De Geer, I just despised him as everybody did. But Aunt Elizabeth had annoyed me, and when I am annoyed I can write very sarcastically. And again I felt that something was writing through me, but a very different something from the usual one, a malicious, mocking something that enjoyed making fun of poor, lazy, shiftless, lying, silly, hypocritical old Peter De Geer. Ideas, words, rhymed, all seemed to drop into place while that something chuckled. I thought the poem was so clever that I couldn't resist the temptation to take it to school today and show it to Mr. Carpenter. I thought he would enjoy it, and I think he did, too, in a way. But after he had read it, he laid it down and looked at me. "I suppose there is a pleasure in satirizing a failure," he said. "Poor old Peter was a failure, and he is dead, and his Maker may be merciful to him, but his fellow creatures will not. When I am dead, Emily, will you write like this about me? You have the power. Oh, yes, it's all here. This is very clever. You can paint the weakness and foolishness and wickedness of a character in a way that is positively uncanny in a girl of your age. But is it worth while, Emily?" "No, no," I said. I was so ashamed and sorry that I wanted to get away and cry. It was terrible to think Mr. Carpenter imagined I would ever write so about him after all he has done for me. "It isn't," said Mr. Carpenter. "There is a place for satire.
There are gangrenes that can only be burned out. But leave the burning to the great geniuses. It's better to heal than hurt. We failures know that.
"Oh, Mr. Carpenter," I began.
I wanted to say he wasn't a failure. I wanted to say 100 things, but he wouldn't let me.
"There, there, we won't talk of it, Emily. When I am dead, say, 'He was a failure, and none knew it more truly or felt it more bitterly than himself.' Be merciful to the failures, Emily. Satirize wickedness if you must, but pity weakness." He stalked off then, and called school in. I've felt wretched ever since, and I won't sleep tonight. But here and now I record this vow, most solemnly, in my diary. My pen shall heal, not hurt. And I write it in italics, early Victorian or not, because I am tremendously in earnest. I didn't tear that poem up, though. I couldn't. It really was too good to destroy. I put it away in my literary cupboard, to read over once in a while for my own enjoyment, but I will never show it to anybody. Oh, how I wish I hadn't hurt Mr. Carpenter!
April 1st, 19-something. Something I heard a visitor in Blairwater say today annoyed me very much. Mr. and Mrs. Alex Sawyer, who live in Charlottetown, were in the post office when I was there. Mrs. Sawyer is very handsome and fashionable and condescending. I heard her say to her husband, "How do the natives of this sleepy place continue to live here, year in and year out? I should go mad. Nothing ever happens here." I would dearly have liked to tell her a few things about Blairwater. I could have been sarcastic with a vengeance. But, of course, New Moon people do not make scenes in public. So I contented myself with bowing very coldly when she spoke to me and sweeping past her. I heard Mr. Sawyer say, "Who is that girl?" And Mrs. Sawyer said, "She must be that star puss. She has the Murray trick of holding her head all right." The idea of saying nothing ever happens here! Why, things are happening right along. Thrilling things! I think life here is extremely wonderful. We have always so much to laugh and cry and talk about. Look at all the things that have happened in Blairwater in just the last 3 weeks. Comedy and tragedy all mixed up together. James Baxter has suddenly stopped speaking to his wife, and nobody knows why. She doesn't, poor soul, and she is breaking her heart about it. Old Adam Gillian, who hated pretense of any sort, died 2 weeks ago, and his last words were, "See that there isn't any howling and sniffling at my funeral." So nobody howled or sniffled. Nobody wanted to. And since he had forbidden it, nobody pretended to. There was never such a cheerful funeral in Blairwater. I've seen weddings that were more melancholy. Ella Bryce's, for instance. What cast a cloud over hers was that she forgot to put on her white slippers when she dressed, and went down to the parlor in a pair of old faded bedroom shoes with holes in the toes. Really, people couldn't have talked more about it if she had gone down without anything on. Poor Ella cried all through the wedding supper about it. Old Robert Scobie and his half-sister have quarreled, after living together for 30 years without a fuss, although she is said to be a very aggravating woman. Nothing she did or said ever provoked Robert into an outburst, but it seems that there was just one doughnut left from supper one evening recently, and Robert is very fond of doughnuts. He put it away in the pantry for a bedtime snack, and when he went to get it, he found that Matilda had eaten it. He went into a terrible rage, pulled her nose, called her a she-deviless, and ordered her out of his house. She has gone to live with her sister at Dairy Pond, and Robert is going to Batchet. Neither of them will ever forgive the other, Scobie-like, and neither will ever be happy or contented again. George Lake was walking home from Dairy Pond one moonlit evening 2 weeks ago, and all at once he saw another very black shadow going along beside his on the moonlit snow. And there was nothing to cast that shadow. He rushed to the nearest house, nearly dead with fright, and they say he will never be the same man again. This is the most dramatic thing that has happened. It makes me shiver as I write of it. Of course, George must have been mistaken, but he is a truthful man, and he doesn't drink. I don't know what to think about it.
Artemus Scobie is a very mean man, and always buys his wife's hats for her, lest she pay too much for them. They know this in the Shrewsbury stores, and laugh at him. One day last week he was in Jones and McCallum's buying her a hat, and Mr. Jones told him that if he would wear the hat from the store to the station, he would let him have it for nothing. Arminius did. It was a quarter of a mile to the station, and all the small boys in Shrewsbury ran after him and hooted him. But Artemus didn't care. He had saved $3.49.
And one evening, right here at New Moon, I dropped a soft-boiled egg on Aunt Elizabeth's second-best cashmere dress. That was a happening. A kingdom might have been upset in Europe, and it wouldn't have made such a commotion at New Moon.
So, Mistress Sawyer, you are vastly mistaken. Besides, apart from all happenings, the folks here are interesting in themselves.
I don't like everyone, but I find everyone interesting. Miss Mattie Small, who is 40 and wears outrageous colors, she wore an old rose dress and a scarlet hat to church all last summer. Old Uncle Reuben Bascombe, who is so lazy that he held an umbrella over himself all one rainy night in bed when the roof began to leak, rather than get out and move the bed. Elder McCloskey, who thought it wouldn't do to say pants in a story he was telling about a missionary at prayer meeting, so always said politely the clothes of his lower parts. Amasa Derry, who carried off 4 prizes at the exhibition last fall, with vegetables he stole from Ronnie Bascombe's field, while Ronnie didn't get 1 prize. Jimmy Joe Bell, who came here from Derry Pond yesterday to get some lumber to build a henhouse for my little dog. Old Luke Elliot, who is such a systematic fiend that he even draws up a schedule of the year on New Year's Day and charts down all the days he means to get drunk on, and sticks to it. They're all interesting and amusing and delightful. There, I've proved Mrs. Alex Sawyer to be so completely wrong that I feel quite kindly towards her, even though she did call me a puss. Why don't I like being called a puss, when cats are such nice things? And I like being called pussy.
End of chapter 2, part 1.